Welcome to the deep dive. You know, sometimes you really want to get to the heart of a complex legal case, especially one that crosses borders, without getting lost in all the jargon.
Exactly. And that's what we're aiming for today.
We're doing a deep dive into a really significant case, Muwani v. Bin Laden.
That's right. It stems from the terrible 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya.
A truly devastating event. Over 200 people killed, mostly Kenyans, but Americans too.
A huge human cost. And it raises a really immediate question, doesn't it?
It does. Why does a case about an attack in Kenya, affecting mainly Kenyans, end up in a U.S. court? That seems like the first thing people would wonder.
Absolutely. And that's kind of our mission for this deep dive. We want to unpack the core legal fights here, specifically about jurisdiction and sovereign immunity.
Right. Figuring out why this case matters for understanding how U.S. law reaches across borders in terrorism cases.
Precisely. And we're drawing on the court's own opinion, plus some expert analysis to, you know, really get into the weeds a bit.
Okay, so let's start with the basics, the factual backdrop. The bombing itself, Nairobi, August 7th, 1998. Who brought the case and who are they suing?
Okay, so the plaintiffs, the ones bringing the suit, were Kenyan individuals and also Kenyan businesses. People who lost loved ones, were injured, or suffered major economic damage because of the bombing.
And the defendants?
They sued three main parties. First, Osama bin Laden, identified as the leader of Al-Qaeda.
Okay.
Second, Al-Qaeda itself, described as this global terrorist network.
Right.
And third, the nation of Afghanistan. The allegation there was that the Taliban regime, in power at the time, gave Al-Qaeda logistical support and basically a safe haven to operate.
So, Kenyan victims suing bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and Afghanistan in a U.S. court. Let's circle back to that strategy question. Why the U.S.?
It's a really key point. Okay. Even though most victims were Kenyan, the target was the U.S. embassy.
A symbol of the U.S.
Exactly. A U.S. facility, and sadly, 12 Americans were killed. So the legal argument became, this wasn't just an attack in Kenya. It was fundamentally aimed at the United States and its interests.
Ah, okay. So that's the potential link, the justification for bringing it into the U.S. legal system.
That was the core idea for establishing jurisdiction, yes.
So what were the big legal roadblocks they ran into? You mentioned jurisdiction earlier.
Right. Two major jurisdictional hurdles. The first was what we call subject matter jurisdiction, specifically over Afghanistan as a defendant.
Okay. Subject matter jurisdiction over a foreign country.
Yes. And that brings in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, or FSIA.
FSIA, I've heard of that. It generally protects foreign countries from being sued in U.S. courts.
That's the general rule, yeah. Immunity is the default. But, crucially, there are exceptions. One key exception involves commercial activity.
Okay, so that's hurdle number one regarding Afghanistan. What about bin Laden and Al-Qaeda? They aren't countries.
Correct. FSIA doesn't apply to them in the same way. For them, the issue was personal jurisdiction.
Personal jurisdiction. So that's about whether the court has power over these specific defendants.
Exactly. Does the court have the authority to make rulings binding on bin Laden and Al-Qaeda? It comes down to whether their actions had enough connection to the U.S. to satisfy constitutional due process requirements.
Right.
Specifically the Fifth Amendment.
So just to clarify for everyone listening, subject matter jurisdiction is about the court's power over the type of case and defendant, like a foreign state.
Right.
And personal jurisdiction is about power over the specific individuals or groups being sued, like bin Laden and Al-Qaeda here.
You've got it. It's a really fundamental difference, especially in international cases. You need both to proceed against everyone you've sued.
Makes sense. Okay, so the case moves forward. What happened initially in the courts?
Well, the first court, the U.S. District Court for D.C., actually dismissed all the claims, sided with the defendants entirely at that stage.
Oh, okay, so the plaintiffs appealed.
They did. They went up to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And the appellate court, well, it partly agreed and partly disagreed with the lower court.
How so?
They agreed with the dismissal of the case against Afghanistan, said Afghanistan was immune.
Okay.
But they reversed the dismissal for bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. They said the case against them could go forward.
Interesting split. Let's tackle Afghanistan first. Why did they win on sovereign immunity under FSIA? What was the court's reasoning?
So, as we said, FSIA means immunity is the rule. The plaintiffs had to fit into an exception. They argued for that commercial activity exception.
Right. They claimed Afghanistan sponsoring terrorism was somehow commercial.
That was their argument, essentially that providing safe haven support, letting them train, was somehow linked to commercial dealings or had commercial aspects. But the court didn't buy it.
Why not?
They leaned heavily on a point made in an opinion by then, Judge Merrick Garland. He reasoned that, and this is a key quote, granting refuge to terrorist training camps is a uniquely sovereign act.
A uniquely sovereign act.
Meaning it's something only a government does. It's an exercise of state power, deciding who operates within your borders, who gets protection. It's not like, you know, running a business or engaging in trade.
I see. A private company can't grant refuge to a terrorist group in the same way a state can. It's a governmental function.
Exactly. It's fundamentally about state policy and control, not commerce. So the commercial activity exception just didn't fit the alleged actions of Afghanistan.
Okay, that clarifies why Afghanistan was dismissed. But then Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, the court said the case could proceed against them. How did they reach that conclusion? What was the analysis there?
For them, it came down to that personal jurisdiction analysis we mentioned, the minimum contacts test.
Minimum contacts. Does the defendant have enough connection with the place where they're being sued?
Basically, yes.
Right.
Does requiring them to defend the suit there align with traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice? A key part of that is whether the defendant purposefully directed their actions at the forum here in the United States.
Yeah, purposefully directed. So what evidence did the court look at to see if Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had aimed their actions at the U.S.?
They pointed to quite a bit, actually. The 1993 World Trade Center bombing was a big one. A prior direct attack on U.S. soil.
Okay, showing a history.
Right. And evidence of other plots targeting U.S. landmarks, the U.N., New York tunnels, things like that.
Wow.
And maybe most critically, the court highlighted the fatwas. Osama bin Laden issuing these religious decrees, explicitly calling for attacks on Americans and U.S. interests anywhere in the world.
So the Nairobi bombing, even though it was in Kenya, was seen as part of that larger anti-U.S. campaign.
That's exactly how the court viewed it. Part of a sustained effort deliberately targeting the United States.
And because of that targeting, the court felt bin Laden and Al-Qaeda should have expected they might be sued in the U.S.
Precisely. The court used the term fair warning. By intentionally targeting the U.S., they should have reasonably anticipated being hailed into court, basically, dragged into court in the United States by people injured because of those U.S.-directed attacks.
Even if the injured people weren't American citizens themselves.
Yes. The court was quite clear on that. It wasn't about the plaintiff's nationality for this part of the analysis. It was about the defendant's intentional conduct aimed at the U.S.
Okay. And you mentioned something earlier about a prima facie showing. What does that mean in practical terms here? Did the plaintiffs have to fully prove everything at this stage?
Good question. No, prima facie means sort of at first glance. At the jurisdictional stage, they don't need the same level of proof as at a full trial.
So just enough to make it plausible.
Essentially, yes. They needed to present credible allegations, often through affidavits or documents, that if true, would be enough to establish jurisdiction. It's like saying, based on this initial showing, it looked like there's a strong basis for jurisdiction so the case can proceed.
Got it. So the court looked at the allegations about past attacks, plots, the fatwas, and said, okay, prima facie, it looks like they purposefully targeted the U.S., so we have personal jurisdiction.
That's the essence of it. The focus was squarely on the defendant's actions directed towards the United States.
Which, again, is striking because the plaintiffs were Kenyan. The court explicitly said their nationality didn't defeat jurisdiction over bin Laden and Al-Qaeda.
Correct. The court stated that the plaintiff's Kenyan citizenship didn't negate jurisdiction. The key was the defendant's choice to target the U.S. If you aim your actions at a place, you can reasonably expect to answer for the consequences there, regardless of who gets hurt in the process.
That really clarifies the legal reasoning. So, stepping back, what's the big picture significance of Mwani v. bin Laden? What precedent did it set?
Well, it strongly reinforces that U.S. courts can exercise personal jurisdiction over foreign terrorists and terrorist groups who intentionally target U.S. interests.
Even if the attack happens abroad.
Yes, even if the attack happens abroad, and even if most of the direct victims aren't Americans. If the intent was to strike at the U.S., that can be enough to establish the connection for jurisdiction.
But you also noted it wasn't creating brand new law out of whole cloth, right? It was applying existing ideas.
Exactly. It wasn't some radical new doctrine. It was the application of those established minimum contacts and purposeful direction principles to the specific context of international terrorism. Its significance is in how it applied those ideas.
And of course, we have the other side of the coin, the limits shown by the Afghanistan part of the case.
Absolutely. The dismissal based on FSIA underscores how difficult it remains to sue foreign states in U.S. courts. Sovereign immunity is a very high bar.
Even for alleged support of terrorism.
Even then, the court's distinction between sovereign acts and commercial acts is critical there. It really highlights the different legal tracks for non-state actors versus actual governments.
And the court also acknowledged the international law aspect, right? That targeting embassies and civilians violates international norms.
Yes, they did note that the bombing was a flagrant violation of international law, which was relevant for other claims in the case, like those under the Alien Tort Claims Act, though our focus today was mainly the jurisdictional battle.
Okay, so summing it all up, U.S. courts can reach foreign terrorists targeting the U.S. even overseas and affecting non-Americans, but suing foreign states for similar actions is much, much harder because of sovereign immunity.
That's a great summary. It captures the core tension and the key takeaways from Wani. It really shows how domestic law grapples with global events.
It really does. It's fascinating and sobering. So, thinking beyond this specific case, given these principles, what are some of the ongoing difficulties in actually holding these actors accountable? You know, non-state groups or even state sponsors. Establishing jurisdiction is one thing, but...
That's the crucial next question, isn't it? You're absolutely right. Getting jurisdiction, like in Mwani over bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, is just the first step. Actually enforcing a judgment against shadowy non-state groups operating overseas is incredibly difficult, practically and legally.
Right. Collecting damages seems almost impossible sometimes.
It can be. And for state sponsors, while FSIA has some terrorism-related exceptions added over the years, proving state sponsorship to the required legal standard and navigating the political sensitivities is still hugely challenging.
You mentioned the Alien Tort Claims Act.
Yes. The scope of the ATCA itself, its application in terrorism and human rights cases, is still something the courts are figuring out. There's ongoing litigation and debate about how far it reaches, so... yes, plenty of ongoing complexities.
Definitely sounds like fertile ground for future deep dives. This has been incredibly insightful, really helping to clarify the legal mechanics behind such a significant case.
Glad we could unpack it a bit. It's a complex area where law and global events collide directly.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again for walking us through Mwani v. Bin Laden. Until next time, keep thinking critically.